last 100 years, Hartford's gone from being the richest city in the country to the poorest. The city's in crisis, from public education to public safety. The question for Hartford today is, have we reached the bottom? Is Hartford turning around?
Welcome to Hartford 2020, a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. I'm Jay Hughes, Associate Director of Institutional Research and Planning at Trinity College.
And I'm Ivan Kuzik, the Director of the city's Data Center at Trinity College. Stay tuned for an hour exploring the future of Hartford.
Today on Hartford 2020, we're speaking with Edwin Vargas. Edwin Vargas is former chair of the Hartford Labor Council and former president of the Hartford Teachers Union, and he's a veteran Hartford activist.
You moved to Hartford in 1972. At that time, Puerto Ricans were just beginning to make their presence felt politically. I'm wondering if you can kind of recall those days for the listeners and just sort of explain what was going on and some of the difficulties the community was having being recognized by, you know, the dominant political groups in the city.
Well, it was a very poor community. It was a growing community, but a very poor community. Mostly people had come to work in agriculture in Connecticut, in Connecticut Valley. And a lot of tobacco workers, people worked in tree nurseries and other agricultural endeavors. Some had come from New Jersey. They'd worked in the canning industry in New Jersey. And it was a poor community. It was a largely rural community. It would come from the rural parts of the island of Puerto Rico. So, in essence, it was a community that was having great difficulties adapting to urban life. And when you add in the fact that compounded the difficulty, which was that it was a different culture, a different language, different environment, different climate, all were complicating factors. Although I've often told people that the people who migrated to San Juan and to the urban areas in Puerto Rico went through many of the same problems when they left the rural areas after the demise of the sugarcane industry.
Well, talking about culture shock, you were born in Brooklyn and you moved to Puerto Rico when you were 11. Was that culture shock for you?
It was difficult because I had never really read Spanish. By the time I arrived in Puerto Rico, I was going to sixth grade in English. And there was a little bit of an off schedule, too, because classes here start in September. They end in June. Over there, they start in August and end in May. So my summer session was a very brief summer session before I had to go into repeat the sixth grade, I believe I repeated. And then I moved on. But I caught up fairly quickly.
You graduated from the University of Puerto Rico.
That's no, I actually did 3 years worth of credits at the University of Puerto Rico. But then I went as a literacy volunteer to Central America for a couple of years. I spent in Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama. And when I returned to finish my senior year, a friend of mine showed me an small advertisement in the Hartford, that there was a job in Hartford for people who were fluent in English and Spanish and which would pay for their senior year of college at the University of Hartford. This was an English newspaper called the San Juan Star, the Puerto Rico's only English newspaper. And I saw the ad, I went to an interview, and I was interviewed by Maria Sanchez, who was an activist in Hartford at the time. And she interviewed me in Spanish, and we talked for a while. And then I was interviewed in English by Adolfo Jimenez, who was the first director of the bilingual education program for the Hartford Public Schools. And he liked my English, Maria liked my Spanish, and I was hired into the Teacher Corps program, which was a federally funded program. And I did an internship at the Michael D. Fox Elementary School, which now is an elderly center there on Washington Street. And after that, I received an offer for a full-time job the following year, 73-74 school year. And that was at Bulkley High School. The last year that school was located at 470 Maple Avenue. before they moved on to the new school on Weathersfield Avenue. It was interesting, and I came in to Hartford, and basically part of a second wave of migration of professionals that were hired to help the community, a poor community that felt the school system was not really meeting their needs.
Independence politics was big in Puerto Rico, late 60s?
Yes, it was changing, too, because the pro-independence movement in Puerto Rico had been a national, purely nationalistic movement, and sometimes center nationalistic and sometimes even right-wing nationalistic. But during the 60s, with the New Left and in the United States and with the emergence of the national liberation movements throughout Latin America and the many different currencies, the influence of Cuba, there was a new pro-independence movement that was left-leaning and socialistic. And it was a time when there were very many different ideas. Prior to that, I would say like in the 1950s, the left was not nationalistic. It was the Puerto Rican Communist Party. And the Puerto Rican Communist Party was a chapter of the American Communist Party. And they had great ideological differences with the Nationalist Party, which was the pro-independence party. And the left and the nationalist actually had committed several acts of violence against each other, even in New York. So it was a new hybrid that was emerging in the 60s of nationalists and lefties hanging out together. That was something hadn't been seen in the history of Puerto Rico.
So the communists were for statehood, or...?
The communists were for statehood. Yes, I believe they really were, because they took their lead from the continental United States, the Communist Party here. They were internationalists, really. They didn't believe in boundaries. They believed in the international proletariat. And as internationalists, they saw the nationalists as being a reactionary force, and I think they also they were part of the New Deal coalition. They believed in the united front politics of the left and the labor movement during the New Deal and during the Depression. They had supported, as a matter of fact, I had a maternal great uncle that was a brigadista in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, part of a group of 32 Puerto Ricans who joined the Abraham Lincoln Brigade to go fight fascism in Spain in 1937. And he came back wounded and died shortly after returning to the island in the late 30s. His name was, I can remember it right now. They kind of tried to erase it from the family history because they called him a communist, which he probably was. His name was Herminio Avilés Valencia, and I've had some research done with the brigades, but in those days they had to use made-up names because the State Department had a non-intervention policy, so it was a felony to get involved in the Spanish Civil War.
So his party name is probably John Smith or something.
Yeah, so we're still trying to figure it out. I believe there's still one Abraham Lincoln veteran who lives in Puerto Rico. From that brigade, and I still support ALBA, which is the organization that keeps their legacy alive.
Now, when you arrived in 72, you pretty much pretty quickly got swept up in the politics. It was more than just a job teaching children.
Well, it had been made very clear to me and to those that came with me. There were about 30 of us that came in that first teacher corps program, that the reason the community was inviting professionals to Hartford was that we were here to serve the children of the migrant farm workers, and that we were here to help the community, and that we were to see our jobs more than as just teachers, but that we were to see our jobs as community activists, as advocates for the community, and to help develop the community. So I think that was part of the whole screening process when the interns were selected. And my profile as having been a literacy volunteer working with indigenous people in Central America was something that they liked, the people that had interviewed me. And Maria Sanchez always reminded me and said, you know, the only reason you guys got your professional jobs with the salaries you get and with your fringe benefits you get is because there's a community here. Otherwise, Hartford would have never gone out looking to hire you. So, and I think the first group that came here understood that, and there was a strong link between in the community. I think in those days there were less there was less social stratification because we were such an oppressed minority that you would have a farm worker, a lawyer, a teacher, a mechanic, you know, all be close friends and enjoy social events together. We hadn't yet developed class distinctions in the Puerto Rican community, although, you know, I knew it was probably coming down the road, or, and we were trying to delay it as much as possible. But we knew what had happened with the African-American experience and the creation of two African-American communities, 90% living in abject urban poverty and 10% becoming part of the middle class and moving to suburbia, and how, you know, there had been a growing gap between those communities. And we were hoping we could put that off for as long as possible and try to keep it one happy family.
To what extent was Puerto Rican activism inspired by African-American movement like the Black Panthers and other militants?
I believe it was influenced by Malcolm X, by Martin Luther King Jr. I believe it was influenced by Cesar Chavez and the Mexicans. I believe all those. We had an effort here to create a farm workers union, and Cesar Chavez came to Hartford several times, and I was very happy to be associated with him, and I was his coordinator on several of his boycotts, including the Red Coach Lettuce, the Gallo Wine. I was always fighting with other unions here in Connecticut because, especially the supermarket, you know, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, felt that we were hurting a union shop by leafleting against products that were sold at Stop and Shop, because people might get confused and think there's a strike going on and it might hurt business. And, you know, and I would have discussions with the officers of that union and tell them, well, listen, if you're so concerned about this, why don't you speak to the management of Finest and Stop and Shop and all these places that you have a union shop in, and talk to the management about canceling that line of products. And, you know, it was interesting. They would say, we pay dues to the Greater Hartford Labor Council. Cesar Chavez and the farm workers don't pay a goddamn penny to the Labor Council. And if you keep this up, we're going to withdraw from the AFL-CIO Central Labor Council. That was the level of discussions.
So, did it take a while for Puerto Ricans to get integrated into labor activism in a way that, you know, won equal respect?
No, I think that that they were instinctively pro-labor, Puerto Ricans.
But was labor pro-Puerto Rican?
Labor, well, you know, there was one union that did a lot of organizing here. It was the International Lady Garment Workers Union. And that's because their director of organizing in Connecticut was Danny Perez. And Danny recruited me to help him organize sweatshops. And we did a pretty good job in exciting people about the union. But whether the union did a good job or not, we were disappointed, including Danny Perez. He's retired now, living in Florida. But Danny felt that the union never serviced the shops at the way they should have serviced those shops.
Must have been hard organizing, because at the same time you were getting into labor issues, Connecticut was deindustrializing. I mean, you know.
That was part of the problem, that the jobs were becoming less attractive. As the reputable manufacturers moved out, less reputable entrepreneurs would occupy the old factory buildings, and they wouldn't really capitalize them or renovate them. They would just run down whatever century-old machinery was left by the manufacturers that had left earlier. They made no capital improvements in the roofs or in the electrical wiring. They just basically ran the buildings down, so you had people working on machines that were very unsafe. You had people losing hands, fingers, eyes, you know. There were places where people working in an environment was terrible, with vermin, puddles of water. You know, you're stepping on a puddle of water, you touch a wire, you know, you get zapped, and that kind of thing was happening regularly. And Danny Perez was trying to get the Health and Safety Committee of the International Lady Garment Workers Union out of New York City to come in and do more. And they did hold some seminars and some workshops, and we did some things, but I think that we felt far short of the mark we were trying to hit in terms of really improving the working lot. And part of it was that they really had the city over the barrel, because the city of Hartford was was losing manufacturing, so they bent over backward to try to accommodate people who were unscrupulous business people. So it was very hard to get leverage on them with such with the flight of manufacturing to overseas and to Mexico and to the southern part of the United States.
Now, Puerto Ricans had started out in agriculture, and so by the really 60s and 70s, they were starting to move
into manufacturing,
jobs.
That's correct. They were moving into manufacturing jobs. Unfortunately, like you pointed out, they were moving into manufacturing jobs at the time that manufacturing was, eroding. So it was not the best time because it was not a time of expansion. It was a time when it was retrenching. So what happened was a large portion of the community wound up on public assistance and all that that entails, which unfortunately creates a cycle of poverty, and it's very hard to break from.
You were saying earlier that as a white-collar union leader, it's unusual for you to have gotten essentially to take on a leadership position and that included blue-collar, because the labor movement's traditionally been blue-collar, but it's making this transition now. So can you talk a little bit about that, about the transition from white-collar to blue-collar?
Well, yes, by that time, we had been growing in terms of the white-collar unions had been growing.
And when, in the 80s?
Yeah, early 80s, mm-hmm. 19. But it actually started before that. It probably started somewhere in the 70s. But what had happened was unions like AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, was growing. The American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, and the Postal Workers Union. There were actually three huge unions in the Postal Service. It was the Letter Carriers Union, the American Postal Workers Union, and there was a third union. I can't recall right now, but there were three main unions in the post office. There was the Teachers Union, which had grown incredibly, the American Federation of Teachers and all its locals in the greater Hartford area. We also represented some state employees. And as the blue-collar unions were growing, as the white-collar unions were growing, the blue-collar unions were shrinking. So you had some construction trade locals that might have like 119, 120 members. Carpenters Union, Roofers Union, Sheet Metal Workers with very low memberships, 100 members, 150 members. And you'd have a local like the Hartford Federation of Teachers with over 2,000 members. So our single local, you know, would cast more votes than 20 smaller locals in the blue collar. And the same held true for 1199, the Hospital Workers Union, and many other unions, AFSCME. They were just huge in terms of per capita payments to the Labor Council. And the way that the vote is structured in the AFL-CIO Central Labor Bodies is that the union delegates carry the per capita of their locals. So when you hold elections, you carry a huge, huge number of votes compared to all these other smaller blue-collar locals. Except the exception was the manufacturing local, a large manufacturing local, which was the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers in East Hartford that represented Pratt & Whitney at the time, had 5,000 members, so they were the largest local. But they supported some progressive reform in the AFL-CIO, and their president, who had been the former Labor Council president, Bill Rudess, when he stepped down, he asked me to run, and I had their support. And that, together with the public sector unions and a few of the blue-collar unions that followed the machinist lead, gave me a large majority of the per capita that was affiliated with the Labor Council. And, then it was a culture. It was still a culture shock for them and for us, because I would sit in with a body of maybe 20 vice presidents. And at the delegates' meetings, everything would be very progressive, because the majority of the delegates from all these unions that paid per capita had progressive ideas. But at the executive board meetings where I would sit with the vice presidents, most of them came out of the blue-collar unions and out of the construction trades unions, and they would have very conservative ideas. Most of them were World War II veterans. And all right, just to give you illustrate one incident was, I invited the Fishermen's Association of Vieques back like in 1981. And the president of the Fishermen's Association came to talk about the damage the Navy was doing on the island of Vieques. And how the coral reef had been eroded and how there was dangerous heavy metals and, you know, it was wreaking havoc on the environment, on the people of Vieques. And when he finished, you know, I was taking a question and answer, and the hostility from the building tradespeople was incredible. They got up and they said, you know, this is anti-Navy, anti-armed forces in the United States. And, you know, we kept on trying to explain, look, you know, this has nothing to do with the armed forces in the United States. It has to do with the quality of life of the island of Vieques. And, you know, nobody here is calling for the abolishment of the U.S. Navy. We're just talking about finding an alternate site. So this is hardly a radical thing. So it was that kind of division. But, of course, motion was carried to support the association. And one other one that sticks in my mind was the time we brought the fourth generation victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These were children that were fourth generation, still suffering from chromosome changes, genetic changes that had been passed from generation to generation, and had created a high incidence of leukemia, missing limbs, and things like this, just to show how devastating. Just basically, their purpose was to educate people on the dangers and the toxicity of radiation. It had nothing to do with who was right or wrong in World War II. Unfortunately, some of our old-timers got up and started saying, you know, President Truman was a great man, totally irrelevant to what the children were there to talk about. They had the little children come with cranes, paper cranes, and giving them to the delegates. And all of a sudden, these little 8-9-year-old kids were receiving all these insults from these guys who
bombed Pearl Harbor,
who were in their 50s, you know, and 60s, and I'm trying to say, wait a second, they're not here to say President Truman was wrong or that the United States was wrong in World War II or that Japan was right. This has nothing to do with World War II. This has to do with the health effects of radiation, how long lasting they are, and it's a cautionary. They're here to give some cautionary food for thought in terms of whether we should go nuclear or not.
But it wasn't just culture, right? There's also a political dimension, because the white collar unions had a lot more kind of new left activists who had risen up to become labor activists, and the blue collar folks were still more kind of old social right wing social democratic, and so there was a political dimension to all
this. There's a political dimension, no doubt about it. It came, I think, the last straw that broke the camel's back in '85, and this is when they decided to vote me out of office. That was 1985, and it was, I believe, largely over the endorsement of a candidate for U.S. Senate. I had supported Toby Moffat, who was the congressman in Connecticut for the position, and the building trades were all with Lowell Weicker at the time, who was the Republican candidate. So, after that fight in the Labor Council, a very political fight in the Labor Council, the day of the election, I remember coming to the Labor Council, and I always found parking right in front of the Labor Council. I was surprised that there were so many cars, Cadillacs and Lincolns, and I couldn't find a place to park my car. So I had to park a couple of blocks away. When I got there, I found that the building trades had come in and were paying per capita payments on huge amounts, their whole Connecticut membership. So if they had been paying 100 on 100 members in Hartford and had been paying 100 in New Haven, 100 in New London, they decided to pay 1,000 in Hartford, and they had brought these big checks in. So they all upped their per capitas incredibly, which was expensive to do, by the way, because they had to pay for the last 6 months back per capita to be able to qualify to cast those votes. But
that was your last big contribution there.
Yeah, they were there with a mission.
You sucked in a lot of money.
And it was a close election, but they did edge me out in favor of Carpenter.
The people like Maria Sanchez that brought you to Hartford, as you became more and more involved in sort of labor movement, which is sort of has a broader agenda than just sort of the community movement, were there people that felt that, you know, you were sort of not spending your time well, sort of organizing on a broader sort of front than just on a community front?
Well, we did a lot of things. One of the things we did was we supported Maria Sanchez to run for Hartford Board of Education. And she was the first Puerto Rican elected to the Hartford Board of Education. She became the secretary of the Board of Education. And we supported her for Democratic Town Committee. And so I think that we did our best to try to help that empower that whole movement of. But were there differences of opinion in terms of what we, whether what we were doing was wise or not? Yes, there were, because the Puerto Rican community was, you know, very socially conservative at that time, and many of the young people and activists that had come in had a left view of the world. I mean, we were affected by a lot of the thinking on college campuses and Paulo Freire and the pedagogy of the oppressed, and we had come with all this knowledge that we thought was best for the community. And so it was a give and take, because they would try to reel us in and tell us, listen, you know, if you go too far out there, you're going to cause more damage than good. So there was always this tension that existed between the old-time leadership that was very grassroots and kind of a natural leadership. But they didn't have a formal education, but they were very sharp people in that leadership. And some of them had become heads of poverty agencies.
Like who would those people be, just off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, it would have been a person like Tony Soto, who was the head of La Casa de Puerto Rico, which was the largest agency. Maria Sanchez herself, she had no formal education. She did finish an associate's degree at Greater Hartford Community College, but that was later in life. And but at the time, Eugenio Caro, who had been a police officer briefly, most of them had no college degrees, very little formal education, but they had a lot of street smarts, and they saw us as the Young Turks, and I think they had a love-hate relationship with us. They liked it when we shook up the system, and they liked it when the politicians were scared into giving them grants to try to alleviate some of the social pressure, and when the agencies got funded because of the problems. We dramatized out there, but I think they were also scared of our agenda, and they were frightened that there might be a backlash by the establishment against the Puerto Rican community.
Was that a PSP, non-PSP thing as well? I mean,
yes, that was part
Puerto
of
Rican
it.
Puerto Rican Socialist Party?
Because most Puerto Ricans were affiliated with the Popular Democratic Party at the time, which was the status quo party of keeping the Commonwealth going. Mm-hmm. That was the predominant political thinking. Because they had left Puerto Rico at a time when that party had been the advocate for the agricultural workers. It had been kind of Muñoz Marín, the governor at the time, had been a partner with Roosevelt and the whole New Deal policies. So I think that they had a strong loyalty to that.
Today on Hartford 2020, we're speaking with veteran Hartford activist Edward Vargas, former chair of the Hartford Labor Council and former president of the Hartford Teachers Union.
Has your own thinking changed on independence versus Commonwealth versus statehood over the last 30 years?
It has. I've come full circle on that. I used to believe that, and I think most people believed that statehood was a permanent status, and, you know, that the Civil War had basically proven the fact that once a state, always a state. And I believe that people also believe that sovereignty was a permanent status and that nationhood was a permanent status. And I think that now my thinking has evolved. I remember speaking on this at Temple University in a symposium on the future of Puerto Rico, where I believe it was back in 1987, where I said, listen, you look at what was happening at the time in Quebec with the Parti Québécois. Nationhood is not necessarily forever. Had the Québécois broken away, it would have been another country. The same is true for many of the Eastern European countries that broke apart. And the same is true for countries that were sovereign but affiliated with other countries. So I'm starting to think that it's more economic realignment than any true sovereignty by any nation now, especially with the emergence of a global economy. It's hard for me to envision true nationhood in a vacuum, just like it's difficult for me. You know, when I went to Europe, I see all these European countries giving up their sovereignty to a European government. And, I mean, England, the United Kingdom is still fighting it. But other than that, I think that's a losing battle. Even.
So was that a pro-statehood sentiment?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean pro-statehood in the traditional way. did you think of pro-state? But I think I've become more of an internationalist. I've gone full circle.
So started Abraham Lincoln Brigades and ended Abraham Lincoln Brigades.
That's right. I've become more of an internationalist, less of a nationalist. Well, actually, I broke with them over the nationalist issue anyway. I broke with the Puerto Rican Socialist Party in 77 because their view of Puerto Rican activism in the United States, in continental United States, is merely being a support group for nationalistic efforts in Puerto Rico, and not a catalyst or a social agent for improving the lot of Puerto Ricans who live in the United States. So it was really the class versus the national issue that led to the split.
I wonder, do you still go back to Puerto Rico, to the island? Do you still have much family there?
I still go back.
I wonder, you know, sort of since the 60s, with the large-scale migration of Puerto Ricans to particularly the Northeast, but now I think the numbers are going the other way. More people are actually returning. I'm wondering, what changes do you see, sort of people coming, you know, from New York and the Northeast back to Puerto Rico on Puerto Rico?
Most of them support statehood, and the statehood party has been gaining ground on the Popular Democratic Party. For many reasons, they support statehood, mainly because I think it has to do with cultural reasons. I think it has to do with the fact that now families live on both sides of the ocean, so they don't want to lose that relationship with the extended family. And I believe that there's been other factors, like some of the growth in Puerto Rico were the Cuban refugees that left Fidel Castro's government. They are so fearful of despots that they see a security and a strong affiliation with the United States. Many of the immigrants from Peru, Colombia, the Dominican Republic see Puerto Rico as a way to get a foothold into the United States. So I think that their whole thinking is to link the two. If Puerto Rico were to become another republic, it would lose its allure to many of the Latin Americans who have moved into the island and are becoming a growing presence on the island. So if you look at where the Dominicans are, where the Cubans are, and where many of the Latin Americans are, they're all for a close affiliation with the United States. And that has to do with the bad experiences many of them had, not only with the right, but with the left in their countries. They felt they were caught in the crossfire.
Does that perspective, your new internationalist perspective, does it also have an impact on the ways you think about things like NAFTA and the free trade area of the Americas? Because, I mean, from my own background in the left, it was a growing realization that, exactly as you said, it really doesn't make any sense to try to hold out for independent economic development. What we need is, okay, there's going to be global economic integration. What we need is global political integration and the strengthening of global transnational policies. And so I think it's a very different perspective than most labor activists have.
That's correct. And I think it's a growing thinking even among the mainstream AFL-CIO now. The AFL-CIO has changed incredibly since the days of Lane Kirkland and George Meany. It has taken a much more progressive view, and they are holding seminars with Mexican trade unionists, with Latin American trade unionists, African trade unionists. Even my union, American Federation of Teachers, which was led for many years by Al Shanker, who was relatively a hawk in terms of foreign policy, has transformed into a much more progressive union. We supported Vieques, to stop the bombing in Vieques and have the Navy stop the bombing. That was supported at a resolution at our national convention a couple of years ago where I spoke. Our national president, Sandra Feldman, actually left the podium and came to the floor to speak on behalf of the Vieques resolution that we had introduced. And it's just a completely different realignment of labor. And I believe that, yes, they realize that the U.S. unions cannot really tackle the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank on their own. And I think there is a growing support for those young kids that are out there protesting. People may not agree, perhaps, with their tactics, but they do, or with violence, but they do agree with the spirit. with which young people are confronting the new social economic order.
Just to cut back sort of out of labor activism, but back to being an educator, how were Hartford schools doing when you arrived in 72?
Well, Hartford schools back in 1972 were more stable in many ways. They had a more homogeneous kind of a population, and I believe that there were less social problems. The problems we faced from the Puerto Rican point of view, which is what I was here to address, were the problems that I had described: language, people from a rural background trying to adapt to an urban area. But there were strong values, strong religious values, strong work ethics. So in many ways we were better off than we are today. The drug problem hadn't become as prevalent as it's become now. The rate of incarceration of young people, that was not at the epidemic levels that it is today. The AIDS epidemic hadn't hit yet. So in some ways I'd say we were far ahead from where we are today. I think we lost ground, and we've recovered some in the last 3 or 4 years, but very little.
Because of Amato, you think? Or
I think Mr. Amato, the superintendent in Hartford, just saw that the accountability movement was coming down the pike. I think he just was a step ahead of knowing that there was a whole impetus on this Leave No Child Behind. He could foresee where the state and federal government were coming in the trend of accountability, and he tried to be one step ahead. But in reality, it's really hitting every school in the country. It's really hitting every state of the union. It's really hitting every town and hamlet in Connecticut because, as you probably know, Ivan, over 80% of the funding comes from the state and federal level. So there's no superintendent that really can stand up to this in their local community and say, we're not going to follow the movement. Because it's a public policymaker. I remind people because, you know, sometimes people just knock the Bush administration and say it's all Bush's fault. But in reality, this was drafted by Ted Kennedy, and it was a bipartisan effort to reinvigorate America's schools. And it was a compromise. And some, you know, we don't like some of the things that Bush and the Republicans put into the bill, especially all this emphasis on testing. But it was a compromise, a bipartisan compromise. And I remember that Ted Kennedy and Bush were on the lawn of the White House calling each other friends and partners in this Leave No Child Behind legislation. So for me as a union leader, I could see it coming down the road. So I, you know, in a sense, my becoming president of the Hartford Federation of Teachers at the time that Amato was instituting some of these reforms was an interesting period in time, because I could actually see that whether we could quibble about the speed in which Amato was implementing the reforms or whether it was some of them, we could argue, such as whether the Success for All reading program was the best reading program. The fact of the matter was that our union had decided at a national level under Sandra Feldman, our national president, that school reform was union work, and that if we really were serious about taking responsibility of saving our unions, our contracts, our members, making sure that we had a voice in where all this was going, that we had to get on with the program. Because if we didn't, the union would become irrelevant in the debate of reform.
But then exposed you within the union in Hartford.
Well, change is always difficult, and real change is real difficult. And we knew that the teachers, you know, we have a very old teaching force, and we knew that with an experienced veteran teaching force like this, that having to go to seminars, learn new methodologies, and going back to school, implementing all this new curriculum, and basically asking people to give up some of their own styles of teaching was not going to be readily embraced by many of the members in our union. And it's interesting because I tell the teachers, look, you see this train coming. It's got the support of the U.S. Congress and the president, the governor, the legislature in Connecticut, the State Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education. It's coming at us. This change is coming at us whether we like it or we don't. We had gone in Hartford through the EAI experience, where the city was so angry at our union that they were willing to privatize the school system to try to hurt us. We survived the AI experience. Some people believe that we actually came out the winners in making sure that we exposed what EAI was really all about. It was really just a profit-making scheme to siphon off the kids' resources. So we defeated them in the public battle, in the battle for the public heart. But then what, were we going back to a failing school system once EAI left? Well, the state wasn't going to put up with that. The state, together with the support of Mayor Mike Peters and the city council, decided to take over the Hartford schools. They put us under a trusteeship. They were going to impose change by hook or by crook. Now, I had a choice as president of the union. I could say, well, here, you know, I could read the tea leaves, and I could put our union on the railroad track there and raise our hand against the oncoming locomotive and just be run over. Or we could say, let's get on board this train of reform, and let's try to talk to the engineer and give him some good ideas to make sure that we have some say where this train is going. And to me, it was simply an act of survival to embrace the reform movement, make sure that our union was preserved, that it wouldn't be destroyed. We had come within two votes at the legislature of losing collective bargaining rights in Hartford for Hartford teachers, not for any other teachers in the state of Connecticut, just for Hartford teachers. We were being singled out for demise, to take away our right to negotiate a contract and simply have the Board of Trustees dictate what our working conditions were in the city of Hartford. And because the bill was so narrowly drafted and was under the aura of an emergency in Hartford, the rest of the teachers in the state of Connecticut just sighed, a collective sigh of relief. And we weren't going to get much support from our colleagues out in the suburbs or in the other cities or in the rural areas, because they were saying, as long as this is just Hartford that gets the castor oil, we're okay. Yes, we did have the presidents of some of the other teacher unions go up to the Capitol and say, this is terrible. And we had a few leaders like John Olson, president of state AFL-CIO, and others who came out there and spoke. So we had a handful of leaders who understood how terrible a president this was. But was there going to be a mass grassroots movement to save the Hartford Federation of Teachers? No, I don't think so. So they would have basically gotten away with it. And so I told the teachers, listen, I see the Hartford Federation of Teachers like a small schooner that's been effective for many years since it was founded in 1949 in running the blockades, in getting the goods for the teachers. And, you know, we've had good captains, we've had good crew, and we've been able to be a successful little union. But in the bigger scheme of things, we have the public against us. We have the city council, the mayor, the governor, the president, the Congress, the Hartford Current, all the media outlets against us. We have the corporate community against us. And we can't take all these people on. So, yes, we could just take our little schooner and ram it into some battleship out there in the harbor and die a heroic death and destroy the union, and then be subject to whatever whims administration wanted to foist on the teachers. Or we could try to preserve the institution that served us so well, the Hartford Federation of Teachers. So I wasn't going to crash it on the rocks, or I wasn't going to commit an act of collective suicide and ask the members to drink the lemonade. I said, let's do it this way. Let's embrace the reform, and let's try to make sure that we have a say. So we were able to achieve in the last contract, something remarkable. Think about this, because of the way we played our cards, in the last contract, which I negotiated, I departed from our custom of always having an attorney negotiate the contract or having a chief negotiator who's a paid professional negotiator. I decided to be the chief negotiator because I felt I understood the issues better than anyone else. And in a negotiation that wrapped up in November, after September 11th, and after the effect of the stock markets, and we knew that the state of Connecticut had a deficit, the city of Hartford had a deficit, we were able to achieve a 4% increase over a three-year contract at a very difficult time, economic time, because the powers that be in the state and in the city said, listen, the teachers have tried. They've tried to address the needs of the kids. They've made a good faith effort. That's why that happened. Had I been on the sidelines there casting stones at the trustees and at the city fathers or at the state legislature and sidelined our union to the role of critic, they would have steamrolled over our last contract. In 92, they steamrolled over our contract, took us to binding arbitration, and they asked, out of 100 items they asked to strip from our contract, they succeeded about 75% of them. That was the worst hit we ever had in our collective bargaining agreement. And that happened in just a one-year contract in 92 with arbitrators appointed by the administration of governors that weren't as conservative or as negative on unionism as the current governor. So you're talking about O'Neill appointees and Weicker appointees. Now, in a polarization, all that would have meant had we polarized at the negotiating table, all it would have meant would have been our contract would have wound up in the hands of Roland arbitrators, Roland appointed arbitrators. It's not difficult. You don't have to be a prophet or a seer to know what the result of that would have been. It would have decimated our working conditions, our salaries, our fringe benefit packages, and even our professionalism would have been decimated. So I'm glad this issue came up because I actually feel very strongly about this, that we have to look to the future. Change is inevitable, and we have to manage change. Now, I was replaced in the last election by a candidate who ran a campaign of fear of change and fear of the future, and who claimed he could return things to the past, back to 1985 when we had elected Bob Vader, who was a pro-education president of the Board of Ed, and gave us one of our best contracts without much of a fight. Actually, he was an advocate on the other side of the table. And unfortunately, the past is not coming back. And the past was not that great for our students anyway. That's what people forget. It may have been okay in terms of our working conditions, but it was not the best in terms of the performance of the kids we served. So here we are today, and in a very clever campaign run against a motto and blaming a motto for the changes, and saying, look, Amato's made us work hard, made us learn all this crap, all this educational baloney. We had to learn it because of him, and we questioned the value of all these programs. We questioned this. We questioned all these changes. And look how hard we've had to work. We felt intimidated because of the trustees and the state takeover, because of EAI. We've had to go through all this change. My opponent ran a campaign against Amato. Said, vote for me for president of the union and send a message to Amato that you're tired, that you're frustrated, that you're angry. And I tried to tell teachers during the campaign, explain to them that Amato was irrelevant. It's easier to hate Amato because he's the visible guy, but he's just representing something that if he were to have a stroke and die and the board were to hire a new superintendent, nothing would change. Because this is the direction education is going in, whether we like it or not. So I think the teachers who voted for my opponent was an act of professional cowardice. I think that they gave up part of their professionalism when they cast that vote. I think that it was a failure of nerve to keep the course. But I'm glad to say it was a close election. And that many of my colleagues stuck with me, even though they worked just as hard and were just as frustrated with some of the changes. But they saw the bigger picture and said, listen, we don't like a lot of what's happening, but we know that we'd rather be part of it. And as a result, in this last contract, I was able to negotiate a faculty senate, which is unheard of in public school systems. It's very common in academic settings, but it's unheard of in public school systems. Superintendents run by divine rights, the school systems, by statutory rights conferred on them by the state legislature. And
so you slipped into some participatory democracy there.
That's correct. And by the way, while my opponent was saying that, you know, he would have no part of Mr. Amato and that he would not even shake his hand if he ran into him, it turns out that when we tried to find out what was going on with the faculty senate, which was part of one of the contractual victories we got in the contract, I received a letter from the new superintendent, Robert Henry, saying, oh, we found out that was abolished unilaterally, not unilaterally. It was abolished in a memorandum of understanding between the new president of the union and Mr. Amato. They reached a secret deal to abolish the faculty senate at the request of the union.
It almost makes you forget there are kids involved in the system, too, huh? In addition to sort of, you know, No Child Left Behind and sort of the emphasis on outcomes and testing, the other big story in education in Hartford for the last 15 years has been Sheff versus O'Neill. I'm wondering, sort of, when the court finally found for the plaintiffs, they found that the children were being denied sort of their constitutional rights to a fair education because of the racial isolation of children in the schools. I wonder, with your labor background, I wonder whether you don't see this more of an issue of class rather than race, and whether, you know, whether Sheff may have not been the most, you know, it might have been the most appropriate means, taking it to the court to addressing sort of the shortcomings of Hartford schools, but whether it's really going to solve the problem of the schools.
Well, John Britton approached me with the idea, and we sat down a couple of times and thought about it, and we played with the idea. And then we involved Bill Olds, who at that time was the director of the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union. And we said, listen, you know, this could be a way to attract resources for the educational system in Hartford, for the public schools. We might be able to get this legislature, because, you know, the way public schools are funded is through the property tax, and there's no way that it's going to be a level playing field unless there is a major investment made by the state, and we can redistribute some of the state wealth. Because basically we are carrying a heavy burden for the region, and everybody knows that Hartford carries a burden for the region. I think it's hypocritical not to believe that. And what happens is I think that the whole focus of this, of quality education, was actually not one so much of integration, because, as I recall, John Britton, at one of our first forums on this issue, was saying, listen, we can have good neighborhood schools given the opportunity. It's not so much of sending our kids to the suburbs or sending suburban kids into the inner cities as much as having the wherewithal to make sure that our schools offer the same things as the suburban schools. So I think there was less of a racial effort really involved here, or a racial integration effort. I was a little concerned about it myself, because having come up with Martin Luther King Jr. and the whole idea of racial integration and the importance of diversity and all this, I was a little concerned about the whole neighborhood school idea, if it was segregated. But the impetus we got from most of the community was very supportive for the idea of looking at this more like a financial lawsuit, similar to the Horton versus Meskel lawsuit that had been filed, and less of a racial integration lawsuit. And, you know, it went through many, many changes, many metamorphoses as more people got involved. I helped recruit some of the plaintiffs for the lawsuit, and, you know, while I was a leader in the union, our union was supportive of the lawsuit. And I knew that there was a danger. There was always a danger that it could lead to our own union's demise if there were a regional school system that was created, because most of our outlying suburbs are in the National Education Association, not in the AFT, with the exception of Wethersfield, which is a federation town. So in a vote in a regional school district, it could be that the NEA, the association, might have ousted us as the collective bargaining representative. But we're looking at it more as the, you know, we have some outlying areas where there are more financial resources, there are more property wealthy than the city of Hartford is, and maybe this might lead to more of a financial integration that would produce the resources for our kids. Now, the way it all turned out was a political settlement that is less than satisfactory. And I think that most people would agree that the Supreme Court really did not take the legislature to task. It did want to rule for the plaintiffs, because I believe that they're good people and they want to do the right thing. And I think that the arguments were powerful about how education is segregated. And there is constitutional language that guarantees an equal education. So I think a fair reading of the state constitution would require that they would rule in favor of the plaintiffs. But in terms of actual teeth into most of the rulings that would force an additional resources into urban schools, I don't see that, because we just have to look at this last budget session at the state capitol. The amount for the magnet schools is almost the amount that was cut from the education budget. There's almost a correlation there. Here, we're going to open these magnet schools on the one end, where we're going to take the resources on the other end. So in the balance, we're going to be asked to do more with less. So I'm not sure that the net result of this was any gain for the Hartford Public Schools.
So what next for you?
What was that question again, Abe?
What next for you?
What next for me? Well, right now, I'm the lead teacher at an adult school in Hartford, in North Hartford. It's 2550 Main Street. And I teach English to non-English speakers in the morning, and then I do some paperwork and discipline issues in the afternoons. And so far we have no administrator in the building, and the teacher is pretty much self-governed the building, so I'm very happy about that. And I'm the building representative for our union, for the Hartford Federation of Teachers at that building. And I'm involved. Eddie Perez just appointed me commissioner to the city plan, which in January will become the city zoning and planning commission. So, and will absorb some of the city council's authority in terms of those issues. So I'm active in that front with the community. I'll continue to be active in the community and work in Mayor Perez's reelection campaign. And I'm also active in the union. I'm active in the community, and what does the future hold? That's an interesting question, because I think that there's a couple of possibilities. But right now, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I love teaching English to non-English speakers. I have students from all over the world. And
that's something new, the different mix of immigrants now to Hartford.
Oh, yes. Yes, I've had students from Sofia, Bulgaria, from Haiti, from Peru, from all over. And it's very interesting. Very interesting mix.
Thanks a lot.
So much for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Today on Hartford 2020, we've been listening to an interview with Edwin Vargas, former chair of the Hartford Labor Council and former president of the Hartford Teachers Union. Hartford 2020 is a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. Guests include former city manager Al Ilg, Councilwoman Elizabeth Horton Scheff, former deputy mayor and mayoral candidate Bob Ludkin, Judge Raymond Norco, and labor leader Ed Vargas. Hartford 2020 is a joint project of Trinity College's Cities Data Center, the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, and WRTC. Your hosts are me, Jay Hughes, Associate Director of the Institutional Research and Planning Office, and Ivan Kuzik, Director of the City's Data Center. For more information about upcoming shows, or to listen to shows on the web, visit Hartford 2020's webpage at www.trincol.edu, that's T-R-I-N-C-O-L-L, /departments/DPTS/IRP/, or call 860-297-2112, or email us at james.hughes, that's james.hughes, at trincol.edu, T-R-I-N-C-O-L-L.edu.